You may be seated. Our third case this morning is 2021-670, the State of Ohio versus Terry Barnes Sr. You will notice that Justice Donnelly is not sitting with us on this panel. In his stead, we have Judge Scott Gwynn from the 5th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge. All right, for Mr. Barnes, Mr. Schell.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. Joseph Schell on behalf of Terry Barnes. I'll be reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, in every case, getting to the right answer means starting with the right questions. And under the standard that this court announced in State versus Xi, the right question to ask when analyzing a pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion is, considering all of the relevant circumstances, does the defendant have a reasonable and legitimate basis for withdrawing the plea? In this case, however, the lower courts asked a series of wrong questions. Not about the specific basis for Mr. Barnes's plea withdrawal motion, but about general and unrelated procedural factors. Mr. Barnes's proposition of law properly reorients the analysis, consistent with the court's directive in State versus Xi, to focus on the two circumstances relevant to the actual reason for his plea withdrawal motion. First, that only after pleading guilty did he learn about audio evidence supporting his self-defense claim. And two, that he would not have pleaded guilty had he known about that before. Those circumstances constitute a reasonable and legitimate basis for withdrawing his plea, and the court should therefore reverse. Before getting to exactly how this proposition of law works under Xi's standard, I want to make sure that there's no dispute about exactly what evidence we're talking about, because I think there's some ambiguity, particularly from the state's briefing, about what the evidence is and whether Mr. Barnes had an opportunity.
I have a question about exactly what evidence. Is the evidence in the record, our record?
The evidence is not in the record, Your Honor, no.
And how are we supposed to?
Well, I think with the evidence.
Why isn't it in the record?
So I can't speak to why it's not in the record. As far as.
You represent the appellants, so it's your responsibility, so you.
I take your point. I think that what the evidence shows, though, is not necessarily material to the outcome of this case. What matters is Mr. Barnes's evaluation of that evidence and whether it would have made a difference to how he would have pleaded.
But how can we know what it shows if we don't even have it?
Well, the point is that I don't think it matters what it shows. It matters what it shows.
If the claim is that if this evidence had been in the record, I would have done something differently, and we don't have the evidence to even listen to it. I mean, how could we possibly evaluate that?
Because Mr. Barnes's proposition of law just turns on these two factual predicates, whether he would have done something differently based on that evidence and whether the evidence was kept from him. What the evidence shows doesn't necessarily play into that analysis for this court. I mean, the trial court reviewed it.
What if it shows he was guilty?
Well, Your Honor, it's audio evidence, so it's not gonna show anything. The evidence.
Oh, what if it hears that he's guilty?
Sure. I think that's still, it's a question about how Mr. Barnes evaluates this evidence and how it plays into his plea calculus. So I think that there's still some room there that even if that were to be the case, but he genuinely believed that other parts of that evidence established his self-defense claim and he still didn't know about that before he pleaded, we're in the pre-sentence context. These motions are supposed to be freely and liberally granted.
Do we know whether Mr. Barnes is aware of everything this evidence showed or this audio displayed? He knows what it says?
So he knows now, yeah. And that's what I wanted to clear up, exactly when he knew that and when he found out about it. Because there's a lot of video evidence in this case. There was, I think, something like 14 different camera angles, Your Honor. And there is
testimony.
So can
we start there?
I'm sorry?
Can we start there?
Yes.
Because it says all the security footage was produced to counsel and that it was marked counsel only. Counsel reviewed that with the client. So this audio that you keep speaking of, are you saying that that is audio of one of these security footage?
That's right, Your Honor.
And somehow one of these numerous security footage films is not with this court?
As far as the video evidence is with the court, the audio would be attached to that. So, I mean,
so if we have all the security footage and we have audio capability, you're saying to us then we do have it?
Yes, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry if I misspoke earlier, Justice DeWine. There is the
so which tape? Which tape? Of all the tapes that I have and I've watched, which tape?
So the audio that we're talking about is audio from the inside of the gas station. It's over the register, and it picks up.
We don't have that though, right? I mean, I can't listen to that audio.
The audio. I mean, as far as the video evidence is in the record, the audio is attached to those videos. So I don't know exactly which camera this is or which tape it is, but the audio that we're talking about is from the inside of a gas station. From the gas station, you can hear the gunshots outside.
We haven't been able to find that. So, what were you talking about before when you said it wasn't in the record?
So, I'm sorry. I'm not entirely sure exactly what the court has access to at this point in terms of the audio.
Well, we have access to everything that was in the record. So, was it in the record?
The tape was, yeah, I mean, the video evidence was marked as Exhibit A in the preliminary hearing because the trial court did listen to the audio evidence. She listened to it before she made a decision and said, and before she ruled on the motion.
So did you ever listen to that tape after it was put in the record? Did you confirm that was made part of the record?
I've listened to the tape, Your Honor.
Did you confirm that was made part of the record?
Yeah, I can't, no.
So is it our job to decide whether he had a good enough reason to want to withdraw his plea before sentencing? Or are we supposed to be looking at this test that's been used by almost all the districts in the state? And more than 30 years after Xi, I mean, are we supposed to be looking at the legal issues here?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And the legal question is whether there's a reasonable and legitimate basis for withdrawing the plea. And if there is, since we're in the pre-sentence context, that's supposed to be freely and liberally granted. The test that Your Honor is talking about, commonly referred to as, I think, the Peterzheim-Heise or Peterzheim-Fish test, the problem with this test is that it prevents particularly the trial court, but mostly the appellate court as well, from ever reviewing the actual basis for someone's motion to withdraw the plea. Instead, what it lists is a series of general procedural factors that don't really have anything to do, particularly in this case, with Mr. Barnes's motion to withdraw. He says that there was evidence that he didn't see that was withheld from him because of the counsel-only designation, and that had he known about it before pleading, he wouldn't have pleaded differently.
Counsel, I thought you said that his counsel went over with him all of the video. Everything that was marked counsel only, he went over with Mr. Barnes.
So Mr. Barnes had four trial attorneys. They all testified to varying degrees of sharing some of the video evidence with him, but none of them testified that they played any audio for him. So his first two public defenders testified they didn't know that there was an audio component with any of these videos. His third attorney said that he thought Mr. Barnes reviewed everything with the two public defenders, so he didn't review any additional evidence with him. And then his fourth attorney testified that definitively no, he did not play this audio evidence for him. So that's really actually the clarification I wanted to start with, is that there's no dispute that he did not know about this audio evidence at the time that he pleaded guilty.
Well, apparently neither did his attorneys.
I think that's to at least some of them, that's right, Your Honor. And only when His last attorney mistakenly gave him a copy of all of this evidence the night before he was to be sentenced. The first time that he had control over it himself is when he discovered this audio evidence that substantiated what he had been saying all along from the beginning, is that he acted in self-defense.
So do you know what kind of audio player or what kind of player that would allow someone to listen to the audio tracks that he heard that night?
Anything that would play the video. I mean, it's attached to, again, it's attached to the inside video of the gas station over the cash register, and you can hear the gunshots outside. And Mr. Barnes believes that he can tell the difference and that he could prove to a jury the difference between the two gunshots, that his was the second one. So there, and therefore he thinks that he can convince a jury he fired in self-defense.
I guess here's my problem. I don't disagree with you that if a defendant, something was wrongly withheld from a defendant, and there was evidence showing that had that wrongfully been not been wrongfully withheld, the defendant would not have pled guilty, that the defendant should be entitled to withdraw his plea. Mm-hmm. But the challenge here is, but how do we, I mean, it's pretty easy for anyone to say, oh, if I'd known this, I would not have pled guilty.
Yeah.
And so I think generally the reason you look at whether it's material is because you assume that people are rational, and if something would have had no impact on the result, unless there's some evidence otherwise, unless there's some reason to think that this person had some particular reason beforehand, that you would not allow someone to just withdraw a plea on a post-plea irrational assertion with no corroborating evidence that this would have changed his pleas. So help me understand why this is different than that.
So the big difference between that and our proposition of law is that there has to be some connection between what the defendant is saying would have changed his plea and some connection to what he's been to his criminal exposure or criminal liability. So there has to be some rational connection to between what Mr. Barnes heard on the audio track and what he was saying from the beginning on claiming self-defense. So if it were wholly unrelated, and I think we used the example in our brief, if he had learned after the fact that sort of candy bars were on sale for half price on the night and he didn't know that before and he says, oh, I want to withdraw my plea now because I've learned something new, that's not related, it's not rationally connected in any way to his criminal exposure.
But if someone says, well, you know, he may say it, but no rational person would think this would help him obtain a not guilty verdict, which seems to be kind of the case here. I mean, this is all, you know, there's no pre-plea corroboration of this kind of subjective, irrational belief that he has.
Well, I disagree that it's an irrational belief, and I also do think that there is some pre-plea evidence that he was claiming self-defense, and he did testify then also at the plea withdrawal hearing that he had wanted to go to trial from the beginning, that his counsel told him it was going to be an uphill battle because they didn't see anything that was going to substantiate that claim. Then when he heard this audio evidence, though, that changed that calculus for him.
Counsel, his prop is a defendant has a reasonable and legitimate basis to withdraw a guilty plea before sentencing upon learning of evidence that one was previously withheld from the defendant. This was not withheld from the defendant. He might have had lawyers that didn't show it to him or, you know, play it in its entirety with audio, but it wasn't withheld from him by the state and would have changed the defendant's decision to plead guilty. Okay, now, I don't know what would have changed the defendant's decision to plead guilty. He says, based on his, military training, he can tell the difference between the sound of the shots.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. It would obviously require an expert to testify, not just your client.
That's right, yeah. His belief is just that evidence would be enough that in preparation for trial, they could hire an expert. He thinks that an expert would agree with him, that they could present that evidence to the jury, and that he'd be able to convince them of self-defense.
Okay, but what about previously withheld from the defendant? If it was withheld, it was not the state.
So that's right. I don't think we're not placing blame on the state for the withholding here. The The effect of the counsel-only designation, though, is that it cannot be shown to the defendant. So I grant you that some of his attorneys shared some of that evidence with him in violation of the counsel-only restriction. But just because his attorneys violated that rule several times, that the idea that, well, if they would have done it one more time, we wouldn't be here right now, is not, that's not how the test works. It's not how the counsel-only designation works. I mean, it was kept from him, and he wasn't able to view it until he had control over it at the end.
So doesn't it also matter that he pled guilty September 18th, 2019, and then on October 31st, 2019, before he was sentenced, when he moved to withdraw his plea, there was a change in the law that shifted the burden to the prosecution on self-defense. I mean, didn't that play into his decision thinking, you know, perhaps if I did go to trial, I may have a better chance at defending myself?
That was part of his original motion, yes. I mean, it wasn't part of the trial court's decision, though, and what he's saying now is that these two factual predicates are the basis for the reasonable and legitimate reason that he has to withdraw the plea now.
Have you watched and heard the tape?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what was it marked when you watched and heard the tape?
What was it marked? I'm sorry.
If we have all the security film footage, and you have watched, and there's an audio track, I want to know exactly which one, what's it marked, so we can all go look.
So I don't want to misspeak. I believe it is camera 14. I will attempt to, I think just the little time that I have left to reserve for rebuttal, I'll try to find exactly where that is for Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Frank Sleznikar. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Cuyahoga County, and I'll be representing the state of Ohio in this matter. Just a little housekeeping issues. Speaking of the cameras, I did call the clerk maybe last week to ask them what they did have in the record, and what they advised me was they had a disc that had a plethora of security videos. Now, I did not view that what they exactly had. I'm just assuming it's the same disc that I have, but I can tell you that the audio portions that the defendant, I'm assuming, is talking about is on cameras 1 and cameras 5. They have the audio track, and the shooting, the gunshots happen at the 2:39 mark, 2:30 a.m. That's where I discovered that's the timestamp of the video. So that's in my records. What the court has in its records, I just spoke to the clerk and they advised me that they had a plethora of.
So those are the two gunshots.
Mm-hmm. Yes, what I've indicated, camera 1 and 5 at 2:39. Those are both from two different inside cameras, and they have the gunshots. Where if this court has that in its record, because I don't believe in the transcript or on the record they specifically introduced those videos anywhere, but if the court does have them, that's where they would be, camera 1 and 5 at the 2:39 mark. Now, when the defendant in this case filed his motion to withdraw his guilty plea, the trial court offered him an opportunity to have a full and impartial hearing on this matter. He was able to call four of his trial attorneys, and he also testified himself. And prior to ruling on the motion, the trial court indicated the number of factors that it would be reviewing prior to issuing its decision as part of its analysis. And those factors were the traditional Peterson-Fish-Heise factors, and he listed all of them. At no point did the defendant object to the use of those factors. At no point did he say to the court, those factors are inappropriate for these circumstances, and at no point did he offer his own proposed test. The trial court denied his motion to withdraw a guilty plea. In the Court of Appeals, he challenged the court's denial. In the Court of Appeals, his basis was not challenging the court's use of those factors. He did not object to the court's use of those factors. Rather, what he raised in the Court of Appeals was that the trial court failed to give proper weight to the factors of the Peterson-Heise tests. It was not until he appealed to this court where, for the first time, has he objected to the trial court's use of those factors and is now proposing now proposing a new test for this court to use, a test that was not passed upon by the trial court, a test that was not passed upon by the Court of Appeals. Now, and he could have done that, because as we all know, the Peterson, Fish, HISA factors, this plethora of case law has all been developed in the Ohio District Courts over the years. This is where this case law has been developed traditionally. And there was nothing that prevented him from addressing the trial court and saying, hey, the Peterson HISA factors are a non-exhaustive list. These factors, i.e. withheld evidence, materiality, is what you should be addressing. He didn't do that. And he didn't do that in the Court of Appeals. Instead, in the Court of Appeals, he adopted the fact that the trial court used those factors. The fact that he has now, for the first time, raised this test and objecting to these factors to this court is the sole reason this case should be dismissed as having been improvidently allowed.
Excuse me, this is a question of law, so it's de novo, so we could look at it, the Court of Appeals could look at it, being a legal question, because Xi was decided more than 30 years ago, and perhaps our silence is what has allowed these courts to develop these factors, and maybe we should look at whether they're obscuring them, the Xi.
Well, traditionally, Your Honor, this case will not pass upon an issue or an issue of law that has not been an issue that has not been raised in the lower court. This is a error preservation argument. This court, if the Court of Appeals hasn't ruled on it, and if the trial court hasn't ruled on it, then this court generally has refrained from ruling on it as a matter of first impression, without the guidance or the without an opinion by the Court of Appeals.
Are you saying we can't take this as a matter of great or general public interest? Because
I'm saying that generally this court will not rule upon an issue or take an issue that has not been first raised by the party raising it for the first time in this court. That's why it should be improvidently allowed. I'm not saying that this court shouldn't ever have a chance to rule on this. If this case had been properly raised and preserved in the trial court, and then again properly raised in the Court of Appeals, then this would be the avenue for him to raise this. But in this case,
how easy is it for an appellate court to overrule its earlier decision?
Well, again, this court could, again, he could have raised, I'm not asking the court, he wouldn't be asking the court in the Court of Appeals to overrule its earlier decisions.
That's
in
what the he's asking for here.
No, I'm not, because the Peterson HISA fish factors are a non-exhaustive list of factors. What he's asking, he had the opportunity at the trial court level to say to the court, these factors are inappropriate, I don't want you to use these, but use these factors. And since those list of factors are a non-exhaustive list, a defendant has the opportunity to craft factors that he believes best fits his circumstances. The courts are not bound to Peterson and HISA and Fish. Those are just guidelines that they are to use.
So the last thing, under Criminal Rule 32.1, this wasn't after sentencing, it was before sentencing.
Yes.
So this goes to, I mean, he has the choice of whether or not to plead, and where does the case law about leave freely given to withdraw, where does that come in to all these factors?
I will not disagree with anyone saying that it is solely within the purview of the defendant when he chooses to enter a plea of guilty. The question is what happens after he enters a plea of guilty, and then down the road he files a motion to withdraw. Well, that's when Criminal Rule 32.1 kicks in, right? And at that point, this court in G did state that those motions are to be freely and liberally granted. However, the focus in G was whether or not the defendant had a reasonable and legitimate basis in order to withdraw his guilty plea. And who decides whether or not the defendant has a reasonable and legitimate basis? And in G, the court made clear that it lies solely within the discretion of the trial court. Now, if you adopt the defendant's proposition of law here, it appears that the defendant wants a proposition, wants a rule that says the only person who can determine whether or not they have a reasonable and legitimate basis is the defendant himself. Now, I urge this court to watch the video that he is now relying on. You will watch that video and you will hear a series of gunshots. Your reaction will probably, I'm assuming, will be the same as mine. You'll be like, how could you tell who fired what, when, at at any point. And his attorney, T.S., testified at the hearing concerning the audio on that video. And he testified that he listened to it, and he said, his testimony was, I don't even think you could get an expert who would be able to tell you.
Well, he said, I don't think.
He didn't know.
Nobody know. I mean, there's nothing introduced that would be conclusive there, is there?
Exactly. He said he was not sure. And he also made the point that even if you could tell, based on that audio of multiple gunshots, that is not indicative of a self-defense claim or who, you know, or whether or not.
Well, wouldn't it matter if there was another weapon shot first, one shot, two shots, and then the client, you know, discharges his weapon? If an expert can tell by the various, you know, whatever the sounds are?
Well, it could be a factor. I'm not just saying that it's not a factor, but we do know that it's not dispositive. Because if somebody points a gun at someone and then that person shoots first, they could be acting in self-defense. So
okay,
who
wait
shoots?
A minute. I just said if there's one or more shots that are heard first and then you hear the weapon that that this gentleman had, that Mr. Barnes had, you hear something that can be identified as his weapon discharging, that's relevant information.
I'm not saying it's not relevant, yes. I'm saying it could be a factor in a self-defense claim, right?
Well, it could be a big factor in a self-defense
claim,
shot first, and then I was the third shot.
I'm not disagreeing with you there. But when you listen to this video, all the gunshots sound exactly alike. Like, I can't.
Well, to you and to me, maybe, but I don't have any training, do you?
Mr. Barnes never testified that his military training was why he was able to tell which gunshots fired first. That's something that was added into the. If you look at the exact quote, the prosecutor says to him, what factor does this video change? And then he says, it changes who shot first. He didn't. His military credentials were never brought up. He was never as an expert. He was never examined or found to be an expert in this situation. So at that point.
So what you're saying is that just gratuitously was thrown in for our benefit.
What's that?
That he was military and could tell shots.
If you look at I'm not going to say that. What I'm saying is when you look at the part of the testimony where he is asked what changes this, he says it changes who shot first. There was no testimony, because after that he stops testifying. His lawyer objects and he doesn't go any further into explaining how do you know this shows who shot first. His attorney objects and the questioning stops at that point.
Is it possible though that hearing this triggered the clarity of his memory and it was clear in his mind what actually happened? I mean, those things happen fast when they happen at the time.
I'm not exactly sure. Are you saying that he forgot the exact?
It's possible.
Well, he didn't testify to that. There was no testimony that he forgot who shot first or what exactly happened. He's just saying that, based on the record I have, it can only be presumed that he was there and he knew who shot first and he knew who shot second.
Well, we're presuming that, but
the lawyer
didn't want him to say too much, so we don't really know.
Exactly, and that's the problem. We don't have a record that was developed on his point. If he would have raised this issue that he is now presenting to this trial court now, he could have more fully developed a record around this issue, and he didn't. And that's the problem that I think that's why this court is often reluctant to take in cases that have not been preserved below, because you have incomplete records as to the propositional law that's being raised. You have a record where the Court of Appeals never even addressed the issues that the defendant is now raising for the first time in the Court of Appeals. Again, this is why this case should be dismissed as having been improvidently allowed.
Sure, but this is all law that's been made up by Court of Appeals all over the state, and the Supreme Court's never ruled on it. Right?
Yes, it's guidance, and it's guidance that could, and the thing is, having been developed by courts of appeals demonstrates that defendants and prosecutors and parties before the courts of appeals raise these specific factors for the first time, either in the lower court or in the Court of Appeals. Meaning that Mr. Barnes, if he wanted to add to the case, the district case law of the Peterson-Heise factors. He could have raised that in the Court of Appeals. He could have raised it in the trial court. And then this court would have an opportunity to address that.
Sure, now, but does Xi need all these factors for it to be operational? Xi's been in effect for over 30 years.
Yes.
Do all these factors that have been come up with by courts of appeals, are they necessary for Xi to operate fairly?
I believe they are. I believe it gives guidance to the trial courts because Criminal Rule 32.1 doesn't have a standard.
For pre-sentencing, yes.
It doesn't have a standard for pre-sentencing. It just says a motion for throughout guilty plea must be filed prior to sentencing. It doesn't say what the standard is.
So Xi says it should be freely and liberally granted, and looks like all these other factors sort of chip away at that, don't
they? No, it doesn't, because it's freely and liberally granted, but Xi makes clear, and freely and liberally language, I'm not discounting it, but it's not even in the syllabus of Xi. What Xi focuses on mostly is that they must have a reasonable and legitimate basis to withdraw their guilty plea. And the person who determines whether or not the defendant's argument is based on a reasonable and legitimate basis is the trial court. It is solely within the trial court's discretion. So all these factors are guideposts created by the courts of appeals and by obviously litigants raising these issues in the court of appeals over the last 30 years, and they've developed a body of case law to give trial courts guidance to how to evaluate these issues. In this case, again, I'm going to keep harping on it, the defendant had every opportunity to raise this issue in the Court of Appeals. He had every opportunity to raise this issue in the trial court, and yet he didn't. And it wasn't until he appealed to this court where he changed his entire legal theory. He went from these factors are good, the Peterson-Heise factors are good, these are fine, these are what we're arguing, and then when he lost to the trial court and to the Court of Appeals, he's now saying, I don't like those factors anymore. Don't use them. Use these and use it in a way that it gives me the most benefit of taking the discretion away from the trial court, and it's my subjective thought of what I think is material. And that is solely what his new proposition of law relies on. I see that I've...
So the proposition of law says learning of evidence that was previously withheld from the defendant and would have changed the defendant's decision to plead guilty. Is there anything in there that takes away discretion from the trial court judge to make a decision based upon those factors?
Well, first of all, in the first point, as we've demonstrated, there's nothing in the trial record to demonstrate that anything was ever withheld from Mr. Barnes. He had every opportunity to review all these videos from all of the attorneys, because the attorneys has testified that even though it did say counsel only, that they were allowed to show him the videos and did allow show him the videos throughout. So the counsel only designation did nothing to withhold this evidence from him. As for your second part, that's where the discretion comes in, and the materiality of this video comes in, and the testimony of people like the defendant's own trial attorneys. Who determines the materiality? And this is where the discretion is being chipped away at. This is where the defendant wants to chip away at the discretion. He wants to say that I don't care what the trial court says. If the trial court looks at this evidence and says it's material, that's irrelevant. It should only be whether or not I think it's material. And at that point, then you pretty much, what you have at that point is you pretty much have a standard of for a motion to withdraw a guilty plea that Xi specifically rejected, because Xi said that a pre-sentence, you do not have an absolute right for a pre-sentence motion to withdraw a guilty plea. And yet that is exactly the type of discretion that the defendant is attempting to rip from the trial court's hands and make it solely his own subjective thought on whether or not this is material. Thank you, Your Honors. If there's no other questions, I would just ask this court to dismiss this case as having been improvidently allowed, since the defendant did not raise these issues or this propositional law below. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Two quick points on rebuttal. First, the idea that this issue was not passed upon is just not borne out by the record. It was on our supplement, page 11. We raised legitimate and articulable grounds for withdrawing the plea. That's in his initial motion to withdraw. In our appellate brief to the 8th District on page 14, We say that Mr. Barnes possessed a reasonable and legitimate basis to withdraw his plea because at the time he was unaware of the existence of potentially exculpating audio evidence. That ignorance alone is enough to require withdrawal. We've argued the same thing here. From the beginning, it has been this is a reasonable and legitimate basis, and the trial court abused its discretion in not granting it. Second, as for the court's evaluation of this evidence doesn't matter. What matters is that, Madam Chief Justice, as I think you were getting at, what matters is that it could be used by the defendant in the exact way that he is saying. That is what this court said in Bethel, in paragraph 35 of that opinion. This is the recent State versus Bethel, is that it doesn't matter whether the defendant's strategy might necessarily work. What matters is that it could be used in exactly the way that he's saying that it could be used. And there's nothing here about these gunshots that's unconnected or unrelated to Mr. Barnes' self-defense claim. And I will make one last point, that the evidence was withheld because it was disclosed under this counsel-only designation, which by its plain text prohibits the defendant from seeing or hearing it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.